Well, Daniele, quite the bounce back for the Jays after last night, a game in which they got dominated by Max Fried for essentially seven innings. But tonight, the bats were everywhere. They were all over Spencer Schwellenbach all night long. A 4-for-5 night for Spencer Horwitz that included two home runs. He probably wasn't that far in terms of combined feet from having a 4-home-run night, which is absolutely ludicrous. 3-hit nights for both Will Wagner and Nathan Lucas, and Jose Berríos shoved for 6 innings, and the Blue Jays oddly grabbed their first win of September, a 9-5 win in Atlanta over the Braves.
Very pleasant night of Blue Jays baseball. I think Spencer Horwitz heard me before the game critiquing the fact that if you're going to play first base, you better be able to hit for power, which obviously the supply hasn't consistently been there for him throughout his career as a professional baseball player, whether that be at the major league level or the minor league level. He said, okay, I'll go show you. Went out and just had a massive game at the plate. Crushing balls. Just destroying baseballs. Both homers. Majestic shots. First one, hanging slider. Then I believe it was a pair of sliders, pair of fastballs that he absolutely crushed. Three of those pitches were down and in, and he just turned on and spit on it and said, thank you very much. It was just so impressive. Berríos was great. Looked like he was fighting something early on in the first inning, but right after that, settled in nicely, was excellent. Has won 6 straight starts, which is he's the first Blue Jays pitcher to do that since Jay Happ in 2016. All in all, very positive night, and it's the younger players. I refuse to call them young, but the younger players that stepped up in a big way for this team tonight to pick up a victory in Atlanta.
That is Daniele Franceschi. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're also streaming on sportsnet.ca and on the Sportsnet app. You can give us a call, 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. You can text us as well, 590-590, name and location. That's the people's text line. It is always open. Standard messaging and data rates may apply. Actually, I did want to read this text very quickly just because it's kind of funny. This is from Brent in Davisville. Is Atlanta playing I'm a Little Teapot when Kirk comes up to bat? I think they are. I'm pretty sure they are because they have an organist, right? Like they have the organist there who I assume they just give free rein to play like whatever they want whenever players are up there. There was a list I had seen floating around on social media. I'll see if I can find it in the break, of like what the organist had been playing. I gotta say, that is one aspect of baseball stadiums. I know the Rogers Center does not have that, but that is one aspect of some stadiums in Major League Baseball that I have always enjoyed, organists. So we need more of those. But hey, let's chat a little bit more about Spencer Horwitz. This is the Spencer Horwitz show tonight. He goes on a night, he goes 4-for-5 and hits 2 home runs. So the solo home run in the top of the second inning, 420 feet, longest home run of the season for Horwitz up until that point, because in the fourth inning, he goes out there and clubs a second home run, 421 feet. So that then, of course, becomes his longest home run by about a foot. He narrowly misses out on a third home run in the fifth. It ends up as quote unquote only an RBI double. And then again, very narrowly, and Holmes was really struggling, but he narrowly misses a home run in the top of the ninth inning. And you mentioned some of the pitches that were thrown to him. So in the first home run from Horwitz, Daniele, Schwellenbach hangs. Like he hangs an 88-mile-an-hour slider more or less right down the middle. Horwitz, of course, does not miss on that one. It would be tough if he did, honestly. So it's good that he didn't. But in the following AB, the AB in which Horwitz hits the second home run, Schwellenbach, I think, was very careful. Like he showed him a lot more respect. He goes sinker to the outside, which Horwitz kind of pokes for a foul ball. It was a couple of inches outside, but he still swung and fouled it off. So you're now 0-1. He goes outside with a splitter, kind of in the same location, but again with the splitter, Horwitz lays off. It's a ball. It's now 1-1. And then the third pitch is actually a 96-mile-an-hour fastball on the bottom edge of the zone. It wasn't a terrible pitch from Schwellenbach. I got to say, like the first pitch that he threw that he clubs for the home run, the slider, it was a bad throw.
Yes.
That was a horrible throw.
Yep.
But the second one, the home run that he hit, 96 miles an hour right at the bottom of the zone, honestly, like it was a, I think that was just a great swing and decision From Spencer Horwitz. He smoked that thing. It's funny because the RBI double in the fifth was thrown in, I think it almost, if you could overlay the strike zone, it was thrown, it felt like in almost the exact same location as the first home run. And it was a slider again, except this time, instead of an 88 mile an hour slider that gets hung, it's an 82 mile an hour slider. Like, you can't be throwing those if you're a starting pitcher, which is too bad for Schwellenbach because he did have a, he's been pretty good for a rookie, but Spencer Horwitz makes him pay. The fourth hit, was off of Holmes later in the game. But boy, Spencer Horwitz is nasty. Like, I said this approximately to you a bunch of times, but I've said this a million times, that Horwitz is on the team next year, and we kind of knew this already. But he is a problem when it comes to what he can do against right-handed pitching. And I think a lot of these guys also struggle to a certain extent against lefties, and Horwitz is what he is when it comes to the way he bats. But like he's also making pretty much no money. He's making $740,000 this year. And because he got called up pretty late in his career, I mean, he got called up last season for like a cup of coffee, but as Ben and Chris were talking about, he obviously has gotten called up for the largest chunk of this season, about half the year. He's under contract for quite some time. And he, for a guy doing what he does to righties, making as little as he does, that's a great place to be if you're the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I think he's got to continue to hit homers. He really does, because it looks like, based on the last few weeks, I would argue it's become a trend. They are exhibiting a lot of caution when it comes to him playing second base right now. And as a result, you better be able to do what you did tonight on occasion. Now, you're not going to go 4-for-5 every night. No, that's not going to happen. But you got to be a run producer if you're going to factor into the equation. That's the tricky part with him, is you like what you see. You like a lot of the at-bats. You certainly love when he can tap into the power. That is a big part of it. Where does he play? Where does he play? That is the big question with him. It's nice that he is cost-effective, and there's still a fair bit of control attached to him because he hasn't, even though despite his age, he hasn't broken through at the major league level until this season. I know, you know, Ben and Chris referenced this on the broadcast tonight. He's now up to 11 homers at the major league level this year. In total, if we account for his prior minor league numbers before the call-up, it's his 15th homer of the season. He's up to 15 homers overall in 2024. It's the most he's ever hit as a pro baseball player. He never had a season in college where he hit 15 homers or more in a single season. So at the very least, you're talking about maybe a guy that did it in high school, maybe, but who knows?
Yeah.
Is it a thing or not? And that is the big question, because if this is sustainable, if the power element of his game is sustainable and he's tapped into something new here, then maybe it does change your thought process and where he factors in to the equation for your team moving forward. The part of the appeal of him playing second base was because you really liked the bat and a lot of the potential that existed there. But if he's going to have to be your DH or play first base to be on the team, you got to be a consistent offensive producer and a threat when you step in the box. Tonight's a good step. He clearly heard us, and he delivered with a big performance.
So there are about 3 weeks left in the season. At this point, there's the last game against the Braves. There's 3 games against the Mets, 3 against the Cardinals, 3 against the Rangers, 3 in Tampa, 3 against the Red Sox, 3 against the Marlins. So that's the remainder of the year. The year is over after that. I've asked this question about a lot of different people, and I'm curious where you fall on this for Horwitz in particular, because, you know, we always say, and for Horwitz, it would not be a small sample size because he's played for much of the year in the majors, but we always say, oh, well, small sample sizes, how many conclusions can you really draw from having a small sample size? And if Horwitz really turns on the power in these last 3 weeks, essentially, starting tomorrow's the 8th, which is the fourth last Sunday in the season. Obviously, the last Sunday is the final day of the season, right? So about 3 weeks. If he starts to hit for more power, would that really change your mind as to what he is? Like, or would you have to still see more from Spencer Horwitz in the power department going into next year? Because I think it's a done deal. Frankly, it's been a done deal for quite some time that he's going to be a major league player with the Blue Jays next season. That's a good. I think that's been a done deal for, frankly, a couple months at this point. Same goes for Ernie Clement. I don't know what their exact roles will be next year, and we can talk about that certainly, but I am curious because I said before that developments down the stretch of the year could, at least in part, help the Blue Jays find out where they really need to spend that money going forward. Because to your point, I mean, if he's going to play at first base and Vladdy's going to play at third, or if Vladdy's going to DH a little bit more next year, and you're trying to, because like you said, the second base experiment seems to be over for Spencer Horwitz. You mentioned to me in the pregame show, but we're coming up on about a month of him last making an actual start at second base, and today he played first, Spencer Horwitz. But I just, if that's the case, and you're getting actual power from Spencer Horwitz, how much more does he have to hit at first base to alter the Blue Jays' plans in free agency and in the offseason? Because I would actually say like there's almost nothing he can do on that. Like if they have their sights set on like Pete Alonso in the offseason, mm-hmm. there's probably nothing he can do. No. I think to change people's minds that Pete Alonso wouldn't be a better power option, because Pete Alonso is probably one of the best power hitters yep. in all of baseball, I would say, right? So if that's the case, then there's not much you can really change your mind to. But if they weren't going to go shopping for Pete Alonso or even Christian Walker, then I mean, maybe that is a way to alleviate if you're not going to have Vladdy play first base because he's playing third base sometimes next year. It's just the trickle-down effect on what happens in the offseason is really fascinating. But I am curious if there's enough of time remaining for that to be changed for you for Horwitz.
Not really. I mean, it's tough when it's only 3 weeks. And he's been in the big leagues for a more extended period of time at this point. The sample size is larger with him compared to a lot of other guys. Is it positive that you saw what you saw tonight? Sure. Is it positive that you think maybe there's more in there in terms of power upside? Sure. But I don't know that my opinion will drastically change. I still think we need to get out of the realm of hoping for things to happen. And you got to start making things happen. You got to start injecting some bona fide studs in your lineup, guys with pedigree, some track record, some real history of success. I hate to put it in those terms, but that's where you are right now.
So let me ask you this. Let's say the plan is to play Vladdy at third base next year. Let's just say. I don't know if I really love that idea. But let's just say for the sake of argument that Vladdy is going to play at third base in 2025, and you're going to have it'll probably be, I think it was Nick Ashbourne who brought this up with me, but it'll probably be like the Miguel Cabrera, Victor Martinez days for the Detroit Tigers, where mm-hmm. like he did start at third, this. But then they would still shift him over to first base like quite a lot of the time. So
yes.
like that, the Prince Fielder days, like those days, right? Like you could probably do that if Vladdy's like starts quote unquote at third base, if you have a suitable option at first base. And again, I think if you're starting your offseason with the plan that Spencer Horwitz is in that first base hole and Vladdy is at third, I'm not sure it's the right move. But if you whiff on Alonso and you're trying to, you know, Vladdy's still moving around the team, he's DHing a little bit as he has a little bit more this season, and he is playing a third a little bit more. If that's like a part of the slam dunk plans next year, I think I'd be okay with Horwitz being like the backup first baseman, essentially.
Yes. I guess, but would I feel great about it? No. Like, respectfully to Spencer Horwitz, I don't want Spencer Horwitz starting opening day at first base.
No, I don't think he will. I don't think he will. No.
Okay, so as long as that's not the case, as long as that is not the plan that they're going to try and sell us and sell the fan base when they get to February and have to address the media and talk about what they've done with their team. And they're saying, oh boy, we're really excited about Spence. You know, he tapped into his power a little bit. Oh God. Again, hope is not a strategy. We've been down that road many times before. Show me something with some real pedigree, credibility on the back of the baseball card that will make me believe in what you're trying to tell me. I think another layer here, show, is the fact that they've deviated slightly from Spencer Horwitz playing second base. Mm. Well, what does that mean for second base?
Sure.
Now, Wagner played great tonight. Another solid night for him at the plate. Will Wagner, I think there's a lot to like about Will Wagner, right? He covers all four quadrants of the strike zone really well, works really competitive at bats, and we've seen him do damage on pitches when mistakes are made. So he deserves a lot of credit. But now that you're maybe removing Horwitz from that equation, where does it leave things? Because Wagner's sample is also very small.
It's very small. I agree.
It's smaller than what Spencer Horwitz had provided at second base. In fact, believe it or not, Spencer Horowitz has played the most innings of any Blue Jays player at second base this season. And that's saying something because he hasn't been playing second base all that long, and yet he's occupied the most innings out of any player on the roster or outside of the organization. And we include IKF, we include Kevin Biggio, that includes everybody.
Yeah.
And yet now they're deviating from that. So what is the goal? What are you doing at second base? Is it because you want more flexibility to perhaps upgrade? That's where your upgrade's going to come? If you are telling me, Show, that you're going to get your offensive upgrade, one of your offensive upgrades is going to come via second base, sure. If Spencer Horowitz then has to play first base, I guess I can wrap my head around it. But as long as you're adding two or three legitimate bats to your lineup that are going to help infuse more power, more potency into this lineup, if that's the case, then fine. It's very situational right now with Spencer Horowitz.
I do agree with you. Like it does depend a lot on what happens in the offseason, and I'm not really sure. Beyond Bowden Francis becoming a real piece for the Blue Jays in the last like month and a bit, I'm not sure there is enough time for the rest of the season in order to say, well, this is like this particular position player problem has been locked up, it's been sewn up, and we don't talk about it anymore because it's going to be backfilled internally. I don't think you even can get there, barring like some, you know, like a Barry Bonds type stretch from one person. And even then, I think you'd say, okay, well, it was only 3 weeks, right? So if that's the case, you're not going to really solve any of these questions until the off season. I mean, there's a text here from Jeff in Niagara. He says, "Do you mean we need someone who had the pedigree of Jose Bautista before we got him? Problem with this organization, all book ready, no gut feeling." And look, it's a fair comparison because Jose became Jose like later in his career. You can never,
same with Edwin.
Edwin too. You can't rule it out, certainly. But it's just, I feel like the chances of that happening are low. Like they're low for a reason because that just doesn't happen that often. And I'm not saying you need to have like every one of your top prospects needs to be taken in the top five picks of the draft in order for them to be like difference makers. That's not, I think, generally speaking, how the MLB draft works, like just from in a general sense.
Yep.
But I think you do need someone with a little bit more pedigree.
Yeah.
For like I'm not even talking about replacing Spencer Horowitz. Cause again, if the biggest thumpers next year end up being added in the outfield, right? If it ends up being like a DH and a left fielder that are your biggest hitters in terms of additions being added to the 2025 Blue Jays, and you go into the season with whatever situation internally at second, whatever situation internally at third and at first base, I think I'd be okay with it because they've shown you can get okay production to even good to great production from a lot of those guys. You mentioned Will Wagner, sample size pretty small. Spencer Horowitz, it's a little bit bigger. David Schneider, perhaps even bigger, but he's had less results as of late. Like there are a lot of differing results from a lot of these guys. But I mean, if you're talking about Vladdy's your starting first baseman next year, and Barger and Clemente are your starting third baseman next year, and the backup first baseman is Spencer Horowitz on days where Vladdy's at third or Vladdy's DHing, I think I'm fine with that personally. And the second base leaves a bit of a question mark, obviously. That can be solved internally. Someone probably isn't going to get traded in the offseason because there are just too many guys to fill spots, essentially. Yep. Like, that's just the reality of it. They could always sign a second baseman. Like, if Ha-Seong Kim is a starting second baseman for this team next year, wouldn't be shocked, frankly, and he would be great at that in terms of defensive prowess, if not offensively necessarily. But like you said, there are a lot of ways you could go in this. 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590. On your cell, those numbers for you to call, 590-590, name and location. I want to go to the back to the text line, actually, Daniele. And there's a text here from Mike in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike says, so he actually texted about both guys having great nights tonight. Lucas and Wagner make singles to center right field look like table stakes. Man, oh man, fun to watch. They are fun to watch, I got to say.
They're good.
Will Wagner is interesting. We talked a little bit about him already, but Will Wagner I find very fascinating, Daniele, because, again, the sample size is so small. He is a bit of an older prospect. But again, I think there is a spot for him on the team next year. Again, to the same conversation we were just having, it depends on what happens in the offseason. But it's interesting because he is pretty much only started at second base. Like he doesn't really play any other positions when he starts a game. I mean, yeah, I think there's maybe even once or twice where he was shifted elsewhere. Like there was a game, I think, when they were winning by a lot and he played first base, I think, for a couple innings. But in terms of starts, he, I think, he's only started at second base
That's
when
correct.
He makes a start. So Boy, I mean, Will Wagner is fascinating to me. I think, again, he probably starts the year 2025 as a Blue Jay and not a Bison. But again, it like the cascading effect on what happens for the rest of the team really does depend on what happens in the offseason, I would say.
I think that's a great point. To go back to the text from Jeff in Niagara, this ties in to his comments earlier. And I think what Jeff mentioned is fair in terms of that worked out for the Blue Jays 10 years ago. They were fortunate that the core of their team, the Bautista, the Donaldson, and in Donaldson's case, there was Pedigree, but when he came here, he really took everything to a different level. Obviously, won an MVP. Edwin and Jose Bautista were castaways, right? They were guys that were later in their 20s already at that point before they finally figured it out. Not everybody's operating on the same timeline. Of course, it's not a linear progression. Things are going to happen. The development curve is nonlinear for a reason. It's a curve. It's not a straight line. And so I get that point. I really, really do. I think it's fair. But when this front office and this organization have, for the past 2-3 years, already veered down this road of trying to bank on a lot of internal growth and improvement, that is where the argument loses a little bit of weight. Because they've already, in theory, tried this.
Right.
Right? Where they've tried to sell you on the potential of Alejandro Kirk, on the potential of Kevin Biggio, on the potential of, and insert player name here. They've tried this a lot, right? And now that they've failed at that, or it's yielded mixed results, a playoff appearance, but no playoff wins, you have to go out and try, because your job is on the line, to go out and augment the roster with something meaningful. That is the difference right now. They're in a position where they can't take flyers anymore. They have to be risk takers, but not with the younger players. They have to be risk takers with guys that have some legitimate track record of success at the major league level. That's where they need to invest their chips at this particular juncture when building the roster. So that's how I interpret the difference, because every team, every organization is going to take those flyers. They're going to want to develop players. They're going to have an appetite to see some of those cost-effective options emerge for them. Of course, but the Jays aren't in that position anymore. Sorry, you're running out of time. The runway is short. You got to deliver as quickly as possible. And that's why it's now imperative for them to go out and get people that you aren't just hoping for whatever the ceiling might entail.
Right.
You're actually saying this is the baseline of what we can probably expect, because they've done it for X amount of years already.
I find these conversations interesting, I think largely because there's so many what ifs when it goes into, you know, when you're going into next year. Obviously, you can't know what's happening because the season's not over yet. And then even free agency won't really get going until well after the World Series. So we're still quite a ways away from finding like the answers to a lot of these solutions. But, you know, I do think it's interesting to have the conversation about how many positions you can reasonably fill from within the team, because, like, I mean, out of necessity, some of them have to be. Like, you cannot, and no matter, I don't care what team you are or how good or bad your farm system is, or you know, at the different levels of the minor league system, but you will, in some way, shape, or form, have to backfill from within, right? And with the Blue Jays, we can have the conversation about what Spencer Horwitz's role is. We can have the conversation about Will Wagner's role. I do think that where it gets really fascinating for me is seeing guys like Nathan Lucas, because Nathan Lucas, I'm genuinely not sure how much he can even factor into next year's plans. He's an outfielder. He has made the most of his time with the Blue Jays, but he's not. I mean, you kind of joke that off the top that these guys aren't exactly young, because Ernie Clement, I think he's 28. Spencer Horwitz is not that far behind him. Like, these guys are not like the youngest of people for guys who are only making their biggest contributions at the major league level this year, essentially. But Nathan Lucas is 30, and he was probably hurt by certainly the fact that he was a left-handed bat, and when the season started, after having a pretty good season last year in the minors, when the season started this year, Lucas was probably hurt by the fact that both Varsho and Kiermaier were also left-handed bats, so you couldn't really have three of your four, like even if you didn't believe in Davis Schneider, which they did at the time, but even if you didn't, do you really want to have three of your four outfield bats be lefties? Probably not, yeah. Right? So you, yeah. Or do you want to have them like, you know, be the replacement for Kiermaier and have them both be left-handed? No, it's the same kind of conversation we're having about Horwitz and Wagner, or we had about them before the experiment at second base ended up being kind of put to bed, essentially, right? So that's, I think that's why Lucas kind of got a little hurt by circumstance, like through no fault of his own, he kind of got hurt. He's a little older, and then I think when he finally could have gotten called up, he had the thumb injury, and he had surgery, and then he was down for a while. It's just bit of bad luck, I think, prevented Nathan Lucas from getting to where he is today. Tonight, though, three hits, playing pretty well, and again, a relatively short stint, so we talk about sample size, it's certainly a part of it, but the last hit from Lucas, I did want to give him some credit on this, it was in the ninth inning.
Mm-hmm.
It was an RBI single, Cassius Clement on third base. The ball, it was a slider that was maybe like 2 or 3 inches below the zone, and he golfs it for essentially a line drive RBI single, to the texter's point. Like, he is making the most of his opportunities. This is what John Schneider had to say, because of course he was asked about the continuing success about Nathan Lucas. This is what John Schneider had to say about Lucas having a three-hit night.
Good at bats, man. I mean, he's, again, quietly, I've said this before, I feel like Nate's been on our team for 2 years, and unfortunate timing with the injury this year for him and for us, but he just has consistent at bats. Hit the ball hard, you know, kind of sprayed the ball around. I love the consistency of what he brings when he's in there. So can't really say enough. Nate's kind of, I think, proven that he can play here and compete here, and just happy for him for the results tonight.
It certainly sounds like Nathan Lucas will probably be up with the team for the rest of the season. Like, I gotta think, right? Because Bo, we talked about this a little bit in the pregame show, but Bo gonna come back at some point. I'm gonna conservatively say by the time they go on the road to play the Rangers, which is mid-September. I think it's the 16th or 17th. I think it's the 17th. This is the off day on the Monday is the 16th. So let's say that's when Bo returns. Someone's going to have to go down, even with the expanded rosters. I don't know. It feels pretty likely it would end up being like De Los Santos versus Lucas, because Lucas is playing so well. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't think any of us are thinking, even if he has a torrid month of September, that Lucas is going to be a Blue Jay, or pardon me, maybe not a Blue Jay next year, but like he could be in the system next year, but that he will be a Blue Jay for the majority of next season, like beyond an injury replacement. Or, I mean, who knows? He could get traded as well.
Yeah. Tricky for a guy that's 30 years old and in terms of what the trade value would be there. However, he deserves credit. I mean, he's looked good and, you know, 10 for 18 since being recalled and added to the major league roster. He's certainly making an impact. And we've seen this before. Like, yeah. It does feel like the Blue Jays do have a lot of redundancy stylistically with some of these younger players. And again, I'm not going to, I mean, he's 30 years old, gosh. But in terms of these
it's
guys that are
you
more.
Say a 30-year-old is like an old man. You
nah,
know?
He's not an old man. He's not. That's not the case at all. And honestly, in his situation, even as John Schneider alluded to, circumstances really just haven't worked out for him. Yeah. You know, look at the roster construction, look at the position he plays, and relative to the other guys there, what his role or opportunity would be like. It's been difficult for him to break through. There, you know, he probably makes this team in 2024 out of spring training if, you know, Daniel Vogelbach isn't on the roster, or if Kevin Kiermaier isn't on the roster at that point. He's probably on the team because you could clearly argue, and I remember having this discussion, and as much as it was, you know, certainly a topic that was, you know, more tertiary and not a primary concern, you're thinking, who has more utility, Daniel Vogelbach or Nathan Lucas? Probably Nathan Lucas, to be quite honest with you. Can play the outfield, can run the bases, hits for average and is a contact hitter. There's something there. But on this team, with their current roster build, difficult for it to work. So he's got the chance right now, and I know they clearly like him. They really do think highly of him. It's just going to be difficult to earn regular at-bats on this team going forward if they do what they're supposed to do. Yes, they're going to have to backfill certain positions internally. That's part of the equation, no question. You can't go out and spend $500 million and just bring in six new everyday players. I know that doesn't work. I get it. I understand that. but it's just difficult for me to envision a role for Nathan Lucas on this team going into next year, when he's also even got a guy, a younger guy, in Joey Loperfido that's there. And what is Davis Schneider and his potential? Can he find a way to rebound? Because they like him as well. So where do all these things land? And given that he is a high contact guy, the Jays have other players on the roster, the Horowitzes and the Wagners of the world, that follow that very same prototypical skill set. They have that skill set, and it's going to be challenging for him, in my estimation, to have a long-term fit here with the Blue Jays.
Yeah, I think Nathan Lucas fits the bill as someone who will be traded for a reliever of some kind. Like, we talk about needs for the Blue Jays next year. I mean, you need to rebuild the bullpen almost entirely. Like, there are a handful of guys, and it's probably Green, Cabrera, Romano, Swanson, maybe Swanson. Like, Swanson's a big maybe. Frankly, there's even a question mark about Jordan Romano making $8 million next year, right? So it's a lot of money for a guy who's been injured a lot. So
yeah.
I think, like, there are not a lot of sure things in the bullpen, and you probably could use some of this depth when it comes to the, like, the Lucases of the world. Maybe less so Barger because he's a little younger, but you know, those kinds of players, when it comes to solving these log jams, I mean, and they got their work cut out for them, the team, because they got to figure out which of these guys will end up being reliable players. But Lucas at 30, I think, does strike me as someone who you could trade and be a starter, an everyday starter for some other team that requires the help in the outfield. Like, I don't know what teams would do that, but I firmly believe that even at 30, he could be an everyday starter for a team that doesn't have a lot of depth. He could be an everyday starter for the White Sox. He can even be an everyday starter for the Athletics. He can even be an everyday starter for the Marlins. He absolutely could be. Like, there's no doubt in my mind. But is he an everyday starter for the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Phillies?
Absolutely,
like, probably
not.
But I mean, those teams aren't trading you relievers anyways, right? So yeah. I think that's where we're at. Like, those are the conversations we're going to be having in the offseason. That's Daniele Franceschi. I'm Sho Ali. Let's take a quick break, Daniele. And when we come back, we'll go back to the text line. I see a couple texts here when it comes to positions the Jays need to improve. Some other texts as well. 590-590, name and location. Still some time to give us a call. 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. We're here until the top of the hour. Again, you're listening to Jays Talk. Sho and Daniele with you on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
He's been grinding, you know, went out there, he had a little bit, I thought he was a little bit dizzy, he just had a little bit of a headache, you know, he's been pretty sick for the past 10 days, and I think just looking at his last two outings, 12 innings and one run, it's pretty damn good. So could have easily sent him back, just didn't really want to push him, you know, 15th win the season, career high, says a lot about Hosey.
Hosey having a great outing for the Toronto Blue Jays. That's John Schneider talking about Jose Berríos and his six innings of one run ball, 90 pitches thrown for Berríos. But great stuff as the Blue Jays do even this series, a one game apiece, 9-5. They beat the Braves in Atlanta. You're listening to Jays Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Sho Ali alongside Daniele Franceschi. We're here until the top of the hour. 416-870-0590, 1-888-666-0590, *590 on your cell. Got about 10 minutes before we are out of here. 590-590, name and location. That's the people's text line, and it's always open. We'll go back to the text line in a sec, Daniele, but I did want to chat a little bit about Hosey having a great night. Six innings, five hits allowed, one run, which was earned, one walk, five strikeouts, 90 pitches, 60 strikes. That was his box score line tonight. He has a 6-0 record in his last six starts. He has a 1.55 ERA in his last six starts, including tonight. Tonight, he nabbed his 15th win, which is a career high. Mm-hmm. I know wins are not the be-all, end-all statistic that they perhaps have been viewed as, but still a career high for him. 15 wins so far this season, and he's at 98 career wins after tonight with a handful of starts to go in the season. So it does seem at least possible. I don't know, likely, because wins are what they are, but possible that he gets to 100 career wins, certainly, this season. But John Schneider talked about it. It was kind of interesting because he did really, like, can't really see because we're here at Baseball Control, but he was kind of like rubbing his forehead, mm-hmm. and he kind of took his hat off a couple times, and it kind of seemed like maybe he was dealing with like a headache of some kind or congestion. You heard Schneider talk about it. He's been pretty sick, so that seems about right, which I think makes sense as to why he did not come back out with a massive lead for the seventh inning, only 90 pitches. I kind of thought, all right, like, I know they manage workloads as much as they possibly can, but I genuinely thought there was a chance he'd come back out for the seventh, but hey, I mean, you know, White turns in a quality start and gets his 15th career win. I guess they figure with a massive lead, you give the guy a bit of a blow.
It's funny, he's been on the mound for each of the last two Blue Jays victories because, of course, prior to today, their most recent victory was a week ago in Minnesota. Mm. And in that outing, the 15-0 shutout win,
that's right,
he only threw 63 pitches, although he was scoreless through six innings. So they lifted him very early in that start where the pitch count was really low. Like it's 63 pitches. I mean, you see guys obviously have a much longer leash than that. So there is something, it seems like, going on there. But he was excellent. The Blue Jays have been very good and have fared well in Berrios starts this year. You mentioned the career high 15 wins for him individually, but the Jays on the season now 20-9 when Jose Berrios takes the mound for them. That is very positive.
That's great,
very encouraging, yeah, to see that level of winning production come while one of your main starters is on the hill. The main thing with him, it's the same story routinely. If he commands his fastball, the other stuff works off his fastball really, really well. And today felt like his changeup wasn't necessarily getting to where he wanted it to be early on. As he progressed, it was a lot better, and his slurve is always nasty. He was just excellent and a joy to watch yet again in what is now his sixth consecutive win.
So he threw 90 pitches tonight, and you mentioned the fastball usage. He leaned heavily on the sinker. He threw it 37 of 90 times. He threw the slurve 23 times, which, as we've discussed, is a pitch he has had trouble with this season. Like, we know that is, when it's working, his best pitch. But this season, like on the whole of the season, I've found he has leaned less on the slurve because it just seems to be, the command seems to be eluding him on a consistent basis, whereas seems to command his sinker pretty well. So he threw the sinker a lot tonight. He actually only threw, because he'd also in the last couple of starts at times leaned on the four-seam fastball a little bit more. Tonight, 90 pitches thrown, he threw the four-seam fastball 16 times. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wonder if it's because he found a little bit more success with that sinker, but it is interesting to see how the split, like four-seamer or like the quote-unquote two-seamer with the sinker. But I mean, it's interesting to see how the usage of those fastballs has changed over the course of the whole season. Because of course, at the beginning of the season, he was and he had great luck at the beginning of the season too. Like he had an ERA of below one at the beginning of the year. And then it kind of, like, I think that BABIP and the FIP didn't quite hold up as much as you would think. So the FIP really for Berrios. But when that turned around for him, he kind of started to shy away from the slurve. But I find it fascinating to see how the usage of the fastball has both ticked up and down at different times this year.
The interesting thing with his sinker, fastball, however you want to phrase it, what's interesting with that pitch, and we know Berrios has a propensity for giving up a lot of homers, right? He's 28 home runs allowed this season, second most in Major League Baseball. Tonight, obviously, he was able to escape without allowing a long ball. But where he's gotten in trouble with that two-seamer sinking action is when that pitch starts leaning back across the heart of the plate. And that's happened routinely. That's something that he's continued to try and refine is, you know, regardless if he's throwing it arm side or glove side, that pitch has a tendency to kind of leak a little bit. And it's that leaking action at the end that leaves him in vulnerable positions.
Yeah.
And so when he's commanding it well, that is where you get outings like today, or as you've seen the last month plus, where he's just able to get into a rhythm, get ahead, and then put guys away because his secondary pitches are really good. Like they're really, really sharp, whether it's his changeup or his slurve. He's able to create a lot of deception and work off that sinker fastball action. That is important. That's the foundation for him. And it's huge. And we've seen him be elite, not just good, but elite when he's truly in command of all of his pitches.
590-590, name and location. Wanted to get to a couple of texts here the last couple of minutes. Darren is in Forest. Now, Forest is capitalized. So I assume he meant to say like Forest Hill, or maybe that is the name of a town, for example, in the GTA somewhere. I'm not making fun. I genuinely am curious because
maybe he's in a forest.
Yeah, that's the other part of it. I'm not sure. But Darren does text in Forest to say logjam of players, minimal opportunity to show you belong, intense psychological environment, poor development programs. All have to be overcome. Oh, Darren says it's near Grand Bend. So there you go. So maybe where you are, Darren, is called Forest, Ontario. So if that's the case, awesome. But he says all those things have to be overcome. Agreed on poor development programs. It's worked out for a lot fewer people than I think you would have liked for it to have worked out for. And a lot of the best prospects on the team right now were acquired from other teams. So you want to see better, more changes in that sense. But a logjam of players, minimal opportunity to show you belong, dead on, like bang on. Like, I think that's why it's tough for me to say with 3 weeks left in the regular season, less than 20 games, I think it's tough for me to be like, oh, well, yeah, for sure. No answer to question X by September 30th. I don't think we will, honestly. Barring like, unless that question is about Vladdy, you know, being near the top of the league in batting average, maybe. But I mean, if we're talking about the guys for whom question marks exist next year, I don't know that we will.
Yeah, you know what? I completely agree. I also think if I had to take a dart throw and say, all right, of all these quote-unquote prospects we've seen over the last month plus, if I had to say let's pick one position that I'd be comfortable with you internally filling that role.
All right.
My dart throw would go second base with Will Wagner. That's where I would go.
I think I'm with you.
I would go there. And that's even, all due respect to Ernie Clement, I really must say that because he's been great, but I would go second base.
There's a text here from David Nanaimo to your point, and Dave says, the Jays can't acquire five new starters, I think he means position players, for next season. Two of those spots have to be internal options for economic and development purposes. Second base is one of those two spots for Dave, he says. The other can be left field, third base, or shortstop, but only one. And I mean, he doesn't mention it, but DH, I think, like, by definition has to be that spot because I don't think there is, like, a slam dunk DH, like, other than Vladdy, and you want Vladdy to play the field more, right? So I think I get what Dave is saying. I actually think, for me, I kind of agree with you, less so with Dave, unfortunately, that I don't think I would make second base a spot you need to go out and get someone. If you can get a great second baseman, then sure. But if your platoon at second base next year, if you believe Horwitz is not a part of that solution, and that platoon next year is Wagner and Clement, I think I'd be all right with that.
For sure.
Frankly, I think I would be. If you didn't have to expend resources towards second base.
I agree with that. I don't think you can afford to go into next season at third base with Ernie Clement, Addison Barger. It doesn't do it for me. That inspires zero confidence. Second base, I agree. I can wrap my head around. If we're trying to sell a Wagner-Clement tandem there, sure, by all means. To me, that's palatable, but as long as you're continuing to upgrade the lineup with more offense, that's the fundamental key to all of this, is are you doing enough to upgrade the offense in a meaningful way? And if you do it by whatever means that entails, I'm all for it, man. That's where we're at now. Score some runs.
You are always dependable, Danielle.
Oh, thank you.
I would place my bets on you filling any position we needed in the Jays talk rotation.
I appreciate that, Joe. Thank you.
It's always a lot of fun. That is Daniele Franceschi. I'm Joe Alley. Appreciate you all being with us on Blue Jays Baseball, brought to you by the local family-owned Crown Rust Control Centers in Hensall and Lambton Shores, Ontario. Protect your vehicle from rust today. Find your local family-owned Crown at crown.com, Canada's number one rust protection. For Daniele Franceschi, Ben Shulman, Chris LaRue, Tom Young, Nick Blackmore, I'm Sho Alley. That does it for us. We are out of here. Jesse Rubinoff is back with me tomorrow. He and I will put a bow on the series in Atlanta. The Jays will come back home at the beginning of the week to play the Mets on Monday. But have a great evening, everyone. Sleep fast. We'll talk to you later.